Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric Gustafson of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, who assesses the growing violence and instability in Iraq, evident in the recent bombing of the holiest Shiite shrine in Najaf, which killed the powerful Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim and more than 100 others. Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton, who discusses her Nuclear Disarmament and Economic Conversion Act legislation that would shift national spending priorities from expensive weapon systems to people-centered needs. And Reverend Jesse Jackson, who spoke at Yale University about the connections between the struggle for both civil and labor rights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the early 1980s, Archimedes Mendoza, a 19-year-old student from rural Peru, was dragged out of his bed by hooded soldiers carrying assault rifles. His family never saw him again. Today, his mother, a 73-year-old indigenous woman, is searching for answers from Peru's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In its report, the commission estimated that 69,000 people were killed during the 20-year civil war that pitted leftist Shining Path and Tupac Amaru guerrilla groups against government troops. Many survivors in indigenous areas had relatives killed by both sides. Feliciano Quispe Huamani was taken along with her two daughters to an army base where she was raped by soldiers. Huamani is skeptical about the Truth Commission. "We want justice. Who is going to give it to us?" she asked. "Why did they kill my husband? That is what we want to know." She declared, "The Truth Commission has not investigated well." 24-year-old Nathaniel Marshall is HIV positive and a peer advocate for at-risk youth on Chicago's historically black South Side. He is also representative of a new AIDS time bomb in America of young black men who have risky sex but who do not consider themselves gay. AIDS is now the leading cause of death among African-American men between 25 and 44, and the infection rate is rising, reports the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The HIV infection rate could reach 30% among black men who have sex with other men, a rate similar to that found in hard-hit African nations. Most of the AIDS prevention work currently being done in the urban black community is focused on heterosexual women who often contract the virus through relationships with men who have sex with other men in nightclubs and bathhouses and keep it secret from their wives and girlfriends. AIDS advocates say the AIDS problem in the black community is exacerbated by widespread drug abuse and fewer AIDS outreach dollars for inner-city neighborhoods. Two industrial unions staged a brief strike against General Electric last winter to protest high health care costs imposed on the shrinking workforce. In late June, the two unions, the International Electrical Workers, Communication Workers of America, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, won a new GE contract that stopped the industrial giant from shifting more health care costs onto employees and retirees. According to The Nation magazine, unions across the country are regularly resisting management attempts to increase co-payments and weaken health benefits. Since 2001, there have been a growing number of labor actions focused on health care issues among state workers in Minnesota, teachers in New Jersey, candy makers in Pennsylvania, and truck drivers in Tennessee. Rising health care costs are also forcing labor to rethink its stance on health care reform, including taking a serious look at Canada's single-payer health care system. As United Auto Workers President Ron Gettelfinger remarked, "You can't fix the health care crisis in America at the bargaining table with any one employer or one industry." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
The car bomb, which blew up outside Iraq's holiest Shiite shrine in the southern city of Najaf on August 29th, took the lives of over 100 worshippers, including that of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim, one of Shia's most powerful and moderate religious leaders. While the U.S. occupation force blamed Ba'athist Party loyalists or al-Qaeda-connected terrorist groups for the assassination, a tape recording purported to carry the voice of Saddam Hussein denied responsibility. Iraqi police arrested 9 people in connection with the bombing, who they say have ties to al-Qaeda. This was the 3rd and most deadly bombing to have shattered the U.S. occupation since the American-British invasion force overthrew Saddam Hussein's regime in April. Some observers believe that more militant sectors of the Shiite community may benefit from the assassination by opening up political space for their more directly hostile attitude toward the American occupation and growing public support for the formation of a religious militia to protect the Shiite population. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eric Gustafson, a veteran of the 1991 Persian Gulf War and president of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. He assesses the growing violence and instability in Iraq and his organization's call for a congressional investigation into White House manipulation of intelligence used to justify the war.
What we're witnessing is the loss of some of the most important individuals in Iraq. With the bombing of the UN headquarters, we lost Sylvia DeMello, who by far, I think, within the UN had the stature, the ability to deal with the Americans and really press for a more multilateral approach. In addition, on Friday, the bombing of the holy Imam Ali shrine in Najaf was also a huge setback. I mean, over 100 worshippers were killed, along with Bakir al-Hakim, who is a very important and prominent Shiite leader. He was extremely politically savvy. His brother sits on the U.S.-appointed governing council. It demonstrates that even the Americans recognize the importance of including Hakim and his group, the Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution in Iraq, as part of the governing council. But, you know, with his loss, we're starting to lose some of the more moderate, or I should say pragmatic, leaders in the Shia community. And as that continues to happen, what's left are really more of the radical leaders like Muqtada al-Sadr and others, who do also have a very large, in fact, an even larger grassroots following, and tend to resist the occupation much more aggressively than Hakim's group was.
As a veteran of the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War, maybe you could speak to how you could envision a change in the way the United States is administering and occupying Iraq that would reduce the conflict and the violence. What could you see happen in the United States and in the international community in general that would quell the resistance and the violence that target American and other soldiers?
Well, there's no easy answers to that, but part of the solution is really being genuinely multilateral. The administration right now at the UN is insisting that a UN force fall under a U.S. military command, and that's simply not going to work. We cannot expect our allies to contribute forces to a U.S. occupation. We cannot expect our allies to pay for a U.S. military operation. It's going to have to be a UN resolution that mandates a UN force. And clearly the Americans are going to have to contribute the bulk of that force, but it's still going to have to be under a UN mandate and supervision.
Your group, the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, and other organizations have called for a congressional investigation into manipulation of the intelligence used by the White House in order to justify the war. Tell our listeners, if you would, about that call for the investigation.
Yeah, it's one of the most fundamental aspects of democracy. I mean, we entrust elected officials with tremendous power, and we entrust them to be honest with us and to be held accountable when they are not honest with us. And I think that it's very clear that this administration misled the American public and Congress, and there needs to be a full and open investigation, similar to the hearings that we saw during Iran-Contra. I'm not one to jump to the conclusion that there's grounds for an impeachment, but I clearly believe that there are grounds for a full and open investigation. And Congress, which over the years, especially since September 11th, you know, with this administration, has abdicated so much of its powers, but yet one of the most fundamental roles that Congress can play is that of congressional oversight. It's, you know, the checks and balances of our democracy, and therefore Congress should be the one that carries out that investigation. It should be a select committee approach, and there's 2 bills in Congress that call for an investigation. One is Bill introduced by Henry Waxman, Representative Henry Waxman. This is in the House, and it's H.R. 2625. That calls for an independent commission. And then a second bill, which is stronger, was introduced by Representative Ellen Tauscher of California, and that calls for the select committee, which is what we're advocating.
What are the chances that these investigations will come to pass, given that the Republican Party controls both the House and Senate?
That creates one of the greatest challenges. However, it's not the only challenge. The other challenge is whether or not the American people care. And unfortunately, while we did see some concern and there was tremendous media interest and coverage of this issue in previous months, it has kind of died down. And unless Americans really care about our democracy and really want to see accountability and really press their lawmakers to initiate this kind of an investigation, unless that happens, then there will be no investigation. So I think there's going to have to be tremendous grassroots pressure.
Since the occupation began, the peace movement's been relatively quiet. There haven't been massive demonstrations organized. Tell us what you see the role of the peace movements now as the occupation continues, the violence spins out of control, and more Iraqis and American soldiers are dying.
I think one of the most critical roles of the peace movement is to stick to its original talking points. EPIC and so many other organizations were saying that Iraq was not an imminent threat, that while regime change might be an honorable goal, especially with the tyranny of Saddam, it was highly questionable that the best way of carrying that out was through a U.S. military intervention, and unilateral at that. So I think that the peace movement needs to continue to push that and say that this was a war based on false pretenses and that the administration must be held accountable for that. But at the same time, not losing sight of the plight of the Iraqi people. Things are extremely dangerous right now in Iraq. And I mean, one thing that I would just warn against, and I've heard this among some activists, but not many, but this attitude like, well, the best way to handle it is to bring them home, to bring the American soldiers home, to pull out completely from Iraq, you know, that this was a war for the wrong reason, so we should just completely pull out and cut our losses. That's really one of the most irresponsible and immoral things I think we can do at this point. We abandoned the Iraqi people already once back in 91, and I don't think we should do that again. But at the same time, there are very important changes that need to be made in U.S. policy toward Iraq.
That was Eric Gustafson, president of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. Contact the center by calling area code 202-543-6176 or visit their website at www.epic-usa.org. When Congress returns to work following its summer recess, members will have to figure out how to pay for the ongoing U.S. presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as the country's other spending priorities. Not even counting the funds being spent on these ongoing military actions, half of the $800 billion Congress appropriates annually, using its discretionary power, already goes to the Pentagon. This reality disturbs Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton of Washington, D.C., who has filed a bill every year since 1993 that would shift spending from expensive weapons systems to people-centered needs. Called the Nuclear Disarmament and Economic Conversion Act, the measure requires the United States to dismantle its nuclear weapons, following other nuclear nations doing the same, and then to divert those resources to such things as housing, health care, Social Security, and the environment. David Goodman and Mark Stern of the Radio with a View program at WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, recently spoke with Representative Norton, a law professor and six-term non-voting Democrat representing the District of Columbia. Norton, who has long fought for full voting rights for Washington, D.C.'s residents, describes the genesis of the bill and her fight for a less militarized world.
There was a referendum in the District of Columbia several years ago, and the referendum wasn't exactly my bill, but my bill grew out of the referendum. And we decided that the best strategy was for me to, in fact, write a bill and to keep introducing it, because to keep introducing bills for, in this case, nuclear disarmament and economic conversion, after a while, such concepts, even if such bills aren't passed in and of themselves, begin to work their way into our body of law. It's called the Nuclear Disarmament and Economic Conversion Act of 2003. Actually, the title is quite descriptive. because it would require the United States to disable its own nuclear weaponry when other nations enact laws to do the same thing. And then it would require that the funds be converted to human needs, including infrastructure needs, needs like the environment, like health care, like the Social Security Trust Fund, which is going down the drain with the tax cuts for the rich, which is every day just eliminating the baby boomers' Social Security. Those kinds of urgent human needs would begin to be the focus of funds that are now being used, and increasingly so under this administration, for weaponry of various kinds, including weapons of mass destruction. The great danger, it seems to me, sitting here in the Congress of the United States, is what it does, how it impoverishes the rest of the budget. We are fast approaching the time when there simply is not going to be any discretionary money left to do virtually anything in our country. I think what most Americans don't recognize is that most of our budget is what we call mandatory, things that we must do, like Medicare and Medicaid, things that do not depend upon appropriations. Now, the kinds of things that depend upon appropriations are, for example, health care for other than the poor, whatever housing is left, and that is atrophied to almost nothing. The health and human services part of the budget, including the way we take care of children. But huge amounts, and indeed most of the budget, is not discretionary. The defense budget is discretionary. So if the defense budget eats up increasing amounts of the discretionary budget, then we are fast going to become a kind of Spartan state where essentially you fund American troops around the world and you fund weapons, including weapons of mass destruction, and you don't fund very much at home.
I saw a figure recently of the discretionary budget that Congress will be dividing up amongst the appropriations committees when it comes back from its summer break. There's about $800 billion to give away, if you will, to the appropriations committees, not counting the cost of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. $400 billion of that discretionary money is expected to be given to the Pentagon.
So you can do the math very easily there and see what's left. Can you continue to run a country that way? You can run a war that way. You can run a military that way, but can you run a country that way?
As the economy stalls in terms of job creation, has this kind of economic condition raised any seeming voices on your side in the Congress who are willing to say, look, we have got to put the money in the needs of real people as opposed to the military, that a military economy does not create health for the population, and that's what an economy is about. Is this reality resonating in the Congress at all?
Well, to the credit of many Democrats, these issues are regularly raised. They don't get much currency in the press. And to be absolutely candid with you, there are Democrats who also understand what the great weakness of Democrats is with the electorate. And that is that the Democrats are regarded as weak on defense at a time when our country has been attacked. So that those voices are there, but they tend to operate in other ways. For example, on Homeland Security, I'm on the Homeland Security Committee. On Homeland Security, many Democrats argue that the money going to weaponry is leaving the states and localities paying for our country's national security because the first responders are not funded anywhere near what is required. So who is paying for it? You know, you and I out of our domestic local budgets, local and state budgets. Well, there has been some money appropriated here, but if you look at money appropriated for weaponry and for the wars in which we have been involved, as opposed to money appropriated to first responders, you will see where the money has gone, and certainly not been to first responders. Well, I say that to let you know that in order to even be relevant to this discussion, many of the most progressive Democrats have had to talk about how national security needs are being done on the backs of local communities and not as a matter of national priority.
That was Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton of Washington, D.C. Contact her office by calling area code 202-225-8050 or visit her website at www.norton.house.gov. Over the course of several days, the Reverend Jesse Jackson stood in solidarity with striking workers at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Locals 34 and 35 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees International Union represent 4,000 office, maintenance, and dining hall workers who walked out August 31st, 19 months after their last contract expired. They're seeking better wages, more protection against layoffs through outsourcing, and higher pensions. The average monthly pension for those with 20 or more years of service at Yale is $621, while the president of Yale, Richard Levin, recently got a deal from the university's board of trustees to pay him a pension of $29,000 a month when he retires. Jackson has been in the streets rallying with thousands of Yale strikers and their supporters among faculty, students, and community residents, and also held a private meeting with Levin. The longtime civil rights leader was arrested on Labor Day at Yale along with 18 others after they blocked an intersection in an act of civil disobedience. The second day of the strike, August 28th, was the 40th anniversary of the 1963 Civil Rights March on Washington, best known for the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous I Have a Dream speech. Jackson delivers a national address every year on the anniversary of the march. This year he spoke from a platform set up on a New Haven street where Yale employees have been picketing. Hanging from the platform was a banner with the words Bux et Veritas, take off on Yale's motto of Lux et Veritas, or truth and light. The following are excerpts from Jackson's speech, as recorded by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus.
This day in our history has such great meaning. August 28th, 1963, 40 years ago. Been a lot of focus on all the editorials about Dr. King and the dream speech. That was not the purpose of his speech, nor was it the focus. He said there were three reasons for marching to Washington. One was to make a connection with the broken promise of the Emancipation Proclamation, the end of Reconstruction 100 years before. Jobs for all Americans, and civil rights legislation. If you just focus on the dream, which was our desire that one day our nation would be more just and more fair, the dream can become an illusion because the dream has in it no enforcement powers. The dream has in it no budget for priorities. So the issue today is not where is Dr. King's dream, but rather where is America's promise. The Battle at Gettysburg was not about abolishing slavery, it was about saving the Union. Inherent in defeating the Confederates and saving the Union was abolition of slavery. Also inherent in that was workers' right to organize, and thus the birth of the labor movement. You couldn't have had the labor movement coexist with slavery. After all, slavery is essentially an anti-labor movement. And here we stand today, 140 years later, not so much focusing on the dream, but focusing on the broken promises. Yale has much to do about the brokenness of the promise. After all, it was on the backs of those who enslaved that this institution was built. My brothers and my sisters, this may be a short battle or a long battle, will be a battle nonetheless. Yeah. And while you may face the stripes of injustice from the whips of meanness, will be healed by our stripes. There are no easy, not quick victories. But then be strong, not on your back alone, but in your courage. Don't let them break your spirit. Don't let them turn you against each other. Yesterday, I talked with Dr. Levin, as those brave seniors came out of the pension office. He said, when I reflect, maybe the last time it was not a good pension deal for retirees, because on the lower end, they did not get what they deserved. Well, that was true before they sat down, but became real true after they sat down. Yeah. I said in closing, I know Dr. King would be happy today. Yeah. Look out in this audience today, there are many symbolic activities commemorating 40 years ago. He would not have been satisfied with analysis. He would want action. You suffer some time, but suffering breeds character, and character breeds faith. In the end, faith will prevail. It gets dark sometime, but the morning cometh. Weeping may endure for a night, but if you hold on and hold out, if you hold on and hold out, joy cometh in the morning. We fall down sometime, we get back up again. It ain't easy always, but then nothing is too hard for God. And so stand up and keep marching and keep fighting and keep organizing and keep voting. A change is going to come. It's going to come as we march. It's going to come as we vote. There are closed doors in Washington today. We're going to open the doors in 2004, because that's our White House. We will win again. We will win again. We'll win again. This land is our land. Keep hope alive.
That was the Reverend Jesse Jackson speaking to striking workers and supporters at Yale University on the 40th anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington. For more information about the demands of the workers and the latest developments in Yale's labor struggle, call HERE at area code 203-624-5161 or visit www.yaleunions.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, David Goodman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Mark Stern, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.